mamá está en el campo, negrito. Duerme, duerme, negrito, que tu mamá está en el campo, negrito. Te va a traer codornices para ti, te va a traer mucha cosa para ti, te va a traer carne de cerdo para ti, te va a traer mucha cosa para ti. Y si negro no se duerme, viene diablo blanco y sale, come la patita. Yaca pumba, yaca pumba, a pumba, yaca pumba, yaca pumba, yaca pumba. Duerme, duerme, negrito, que tu mamá está en el campo, negrito. Duerme, duerme, negrito, que tu mamá está en el campo, negrito, trabajando, trabajando duramente, trabajando, sí, trabajando y no le pagan, trabajando, sí, trabajando y va tosiendo, trabajando, sí, trabajando y va de luto, trabajando, sí, pa'l negrito chiquitito, trabajando, sí, pa'l negrito chiquitito, trabajando, sí, no le pagan, sí, duramente, sí, va tosiendo, sí, va de luto, sí. Duerme, duerme, negrito, que tu mamá está en el campo, negrito. Duerme, duerme, negrito, que tu mamá está en el campo, negrito.
Ending the program with a brand new segment right there. It's called A Couple of Minutes with Vic. And the inaugural segment focused on the great Chilean artist Victor Jara singing Duerme, Duerme, Negrito from 1969's Pongo en Tus Manos Abiertas. Before that, we heard from Michael Morley and Joaquim Nordwall. In fact, that's what's behind us right now, part one, an excerpt from part one of a great disc on Stone to Death called An Island is an Island. Gracias to whichever WFMU DJ left their copy of this sitting at the new bin. I'll find you. You should donate this to the library, however. It's great. Michael Morley, of course, from the Dead Sea and Gate. Matches. Before that, we heard two tracks from Matches. I've been meaning to bring this CD into the radio show for weeks now, weeks and weeks. It's called Stena. Came out last year on Drag City. Love it. Well, we heard two tracks from it today. Finally, getting around to it. We heard Third Coin, and we heard Clara Kirka. The two of them were split up by a track from another great disc on Thrill Jockey, From Black to Calm, called Oocyte, Oil, and Stolen Androgens. The track we heard, Gepakte Zeit, for Hanna Darboven. Before the first Matches track, Clara Kirka, we heard from Larva, the house band for the Andes Positives label, and a two CD set that came out in 2016 called The Larva Tapes. We heard excerpts from side one, and at the top of the set, gorgeous track from Tony, Carol, and John from 1972's All on the First Day. We heard Waltz for a Spaniel. Oh, I got a waltz on out of here. Make room for Mark. Tectonic is coming right your way, friends, right here at WFMU in East Orange, WMFU in Mount Hope, in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM, worldwide online at WFMU.org. Here's Tectonic.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the next hour. So great to have you with me. I've got a question for you. When I say social media, what comes to mind? I mean, in the context of this show, you might think, well, we've talked about the effects of social media on people like addiction and polarization, and maybe if people are lonely, it accentuates or amplifies loneliness. And in fact, social media does act as an amplifier in a lot of ways. And for individuals, it tends to have negative effects. Of course, in some cases, there can be positive effects as well. But we have seen as systems, they have been designed and programmed to benefit the big tech companies owned by the oligarchs, the billionaire oligarchs, and they're not primarily built to benefit the users. We know this by now. And I've covered this on a number of past shows, so that's nothing super groundbreaking or new. But what I want to do tonight, we're going to be speaking with Nick Couldrey, and I'm going to explain in a second about his book. I'm just setting it up right now. I want you to think about social media from a larger scale. Think big now. So when we talk about social media, don't simply think about what are the effects on one person here and one person there. In other words, don't think for tonight, don't think about social media's effects on individuals. Instead, I want you to think about social media's impact on society at large. Maybe you can think nationally. Maybe you can think regionally in your hemisphere and think globally. What are the impacts of social media nationally to globally? That's the question that I took away from this new book. This is a book by Nick Couldrey. It's called The Space of the World: Can Human Solidarity Survive Social Media? And What If It Can't? Here on WFMU, you can find this linked on the playlist at WFMU.org. Click Playlists and Comments. On Tectonic.fm, you can click the playlist link and see links to the book and Nick Couldrey. That's TECHtonic.fm. Nick, by the way, is professor at the London School of Economics. He's based there in the UK. And this is going to be his second time on the show. He was on the show last year, as you can see in the playlist, back on May 6, 2024, speaking about his previous book with his co-author, Ulysses Mejias, which was called Data Grab: The New Colonialism of Big Tech and How to Fight Back. And you're going to hear in this interview that we do cover data colonialism a little bit. We do touch on it a little bit. But really, what we're talking about in this new book, this interview tonight, The Space of the World, is, again, what does it look like when social media has infiltrated every aspect of our social interactions and our politics on a national and on a global scale? And that's something that has not really been investigated that much in the readings that I've done and in the interviews I've had on the show. So that is new. And Nick is just a very thoughtful writer and speaker, as you're going to hear. So let's go ahead and listen to my interview now with Nick Couldrey, author of The Space of the World, here on Tectonic. Nick Couldrey, welcome back to Tectonic.
It's great to be here again, Mark.
Nick, you were first on the show in May 2024 talking about your previous book, Data Grab, with your co-author Ulysses Mejias. That was a book about big tech and what you called data colonialism. And I'd recommend the book and the interview to listeners. They can find that in the archives. Now you're back with a new book. It's called The Space of the World: Can Human Solidarity Survive Social Media? And What If It Can't? This book is largely about social media, as the subtitle suggests, and what social media is doing to our shared existence as a species, what you call the space of the world. I want to say up front that I Really enjoyed this book, and I totally agree with your premise here, but maybe we can start with this. How do you summarize the risk that social media presents to us today?
Well, there's certainly a lot of specific risks we all know about, you know, mental health of young people, especially young women, radicals going down weird rabbit holes that end up with them turning guns on people, which happens again and again. Massively more polarization of our adult politics. It's not just about young people. Our adult politics is being toxified in so many ways, and we see the fruits of it in terms of the political outcomes we're getting in many countries, not just the US and the UK, but right across Europe, in Africa, Latin America, parts of Asia as well. So those are big problems. The core problem that I see it, though, underlies that. And I got into this because, like everyone else, I was concerned with social media, the specifics, but I had a nagging feeling there was something underlying all those specifics. And I had a feeling it was something to do with space. And the idea I had 5 or 6 years ago when I first had the basic idea was that we made a big mistake about 20 years ago. We had an internet that wonderfully connected us all, and no one's going to do away with that. We celebrate that, and we can't do away with it anyway. It's there. But we already knew in the 90s that there were dangers of some pretty toxic conversations on listservs and some pretty nasty porn getting out there and damaging people in small ways, as it seems now. So we knew the dangers. So you might have thought we would have said, well, the internet is a great connected space, but it brings a new type of risk. Because when you connect 8 billion people together on the planet, there's a guaranteed small percentage of toxicity out there, if you like, real evil. And if you allow that to flow, you're increasing the risk to everyone, and the guardrails are down. So surely we would have said 20 years ago, let's build something to put some guardrails up. Let's build platforms that protect us, that keep the bad stuff in, wherever the dark place is in. And we did the exact opposite. We actually took away all the guardrails. And much worse than that, we built platforms whose business model was to spread the bad stuff around as much as possible and make money out of that. And do it in such a smart way that it incentivized to send even more bad stuff around and get the bad guys out of their dens, say, hey, we can spread bad stuff around in the internet through these platforms. So we made the whole thing 3, 4, 5, 20 times worse rather than mitigating the problem. And the way I sum it up, why is this about space? Because we basically allowed platform owners to do something that no emperor ever could have dreamt of, which is to not just design one space, one town square where there's a camera looking at people, but to design the space of all possible spaces. Any space you could ever imagine that social is now somehow online and on a platform. And we allowed someone to build that space with the wrong business model, without any guardrails, without any regulation. So we basically designed the wrong space of the world. And now we've got to do something about that. And that could involve dismantling and rebuilding. That's the argument of the book. And I felt that we hadn't quite touched bottom with how deep this problem was, because we hadn't got to that basic space that we have misdesigned. It's not just about one platform. It's about the whole thing.
That was a great summary of the book, Nick. And I want to start by talking about some of the roots of these decisions. You say early on in the book that this was not an original conspiracy to take power. It's not like there was a cabal of proto tech bro billionaires who got in a room and decided to amplify all the bad stuff. It was a combination of forces that together made the conditions for this to arise. Certainly, there was an active sense of techno-utopianism. You talk about John Perry Barlow's work and some of the other so-called visionaries in the 1990s who were selling this idea of free flow of information, promoting democracy. And I should admit that as a young man back then, I was a true believer. I could never have imagined that it would go wrong. But there's another aspect of this that I hadn't considered that was a factor in building this environment, which is that early telecom regulations were very loose. You talk about the telephone business in the 1970s, 1980s, had a goal of wiring everybody up without much thought about any sort of outcome. As you write, it was focused on keeping lines open regardless of what passed down them. And for a telephone network, I think that makes sense. You don't need to have a filter listening in, or let alone amplifying what people are saying person to person in a telephone call. But the internet obviously is different. So we had this utopianism with a deregulated environment saying, please connect everybody up. That really kickstarted it, didn't it?
Yeah. But as you say, the internet obviously is different. But that's obvious point. And it is obvious, really, because we've lived through 20 years that's shown us how it must be different. It wasn't so obvious at the time, and people were celebrating that telecoms regulation is enough. It was almost as if each one of us needs our freedom to speak to that one other person who we're speaking to right now. Well, yeah, sure, we need that freedom of speech. Absolutely. I totally believe in that. But that's not what we built. We built a sort of massive pinball machine, if you like, where everything that we push up gets pushed along by a whole massive model that's pushing it further and further, gathering speed until it rockets down at the other end with all the bad stuff that's attracted along the way. We build a whole space of spaces. It's not just about one conversation, and people miss that. It's not surprising they miss that, because nothing like that had ever been buildable before. It was only when we had the internet, which became de facto part of our lives 30 years ago, although its roots, of course, go back much earlier than that, as do some of the dreams. It's only when we had the internet that we had the possibility of connecting up all 8 billion people on the planet, or however many devices they've got. And it's only when the idea of a platform gradually emerged where you could, if you like, focus that impossibly large connectivity. You could focus it in a certain way through a certain type of window with certain type of features, that the internet really became more feasible to use on a daily basis. And I'm not saying that was a bad invention either. It was a good invention. It made the internet a bit more tractable, a bit more manageable on a daily basis. But the problem was, no one really thought, well, how should we design this in a good way? Rather, they thought about only how should we design it so we can make as much money out of it as possible. And governments had their hands off the wheel because they assumed in the neoliberal way that regulation in these areas is bad and we need more market forces. And they allowed, through the power law, platforms to grow, which were so big because everyone wanted to jump on because everyone else was there, that they then become pretty well impossible to regulate, and they still backed off until, in the past 5 to 10 years, the social costs of all this have started to become really clear. And I'm not saying I wasn't a celebrator of social media 15 to 20 years ago. Who wasn't? It was a new thing that seemed fun, but the danger was the idea of the business model that was driving this. And the weird thing is, there were a few people who saw where things were going 20, 25 years ago. They tended to be legal scholars. There was a guy called Paul Schwartz, I might mention him in passing in the book, who wrote an essay in 1999, said if you create an internet space of connection and you allow business to run riot in it, pursuing its goals, which are more advertising, more profit, you will get a space of consistent surveillance, and you'll get a lot of other bad consequences as well. 1999, he wrote that essay. I don't know how many hundreds of people read the essay. It must have seemed pretty far out at the time. But of course, he was exactly right, because he was seeing the trend, the direction in which we were going. And as you say, those ideals of the early internet were looking in exactly the wrong direction. They were thinking of freedom of individual speech, as if you're just speaking to one other person or a small group, not imagining the space that we created. And that's what I'm trying to get through in the book, that the core mistake we've made is of misdesigning the space in which we spend our time together. And it's a deep mistake. It underlies all the other mistakes. And then once you've misdesigned it, and then you add in a toxic business model, that exploits the bad thing about that design, then you've got a really dangerous situation. And that's exactly what we've done. And we're still barely beginning to regulate it, even now, 20 years later.
As you write early in the book, the error of allowing commercial forces to design the basic conditions under which we socially interact was that we have delegated the design of our world to businesses whose goal is profit and not good social design. Now, some people hearing this will say, well, Nick, what else is new? Companies pursue profit and they have some sort of outcomes on society. But you take pains in this book to argue, I think very persuasively, that something new is actually happening. Of course, profit-seeking corporations have always done their thing. That's not new. But there is a scale to this operation that has never been seen before in human history. And you unpack that in a number of ways. One of the things that you talk about that I liked a lot was this idea of boundaries, that the social media companies, big tech, is in the business of dissolving boundaries. And I mean any sorts of boundaries that might have been in place for good reason before then. For example, you write, social boundaries are important. Boundaries are important to building social life. But big tech stripped away all the barriers that might limit the flows of information between social contexts. Can you say more about this? Why is it so important for us to maintain, or these days, I guess, try to rebuild some boundaries in our social interactions that big tech has tried to dissolve?
Yeah, this is a really fundamental point. All of us probably start off from the thing we want freedom in our social life. We want to be able to speak freely, think freely, and so on. I'm just rereading 1984 at the moment, and it's an unimaginably dark book where that is completely impossible. Even our thoughts have already been policed. No one wants anything like that. But that's not the same as saying that we can be entirely free without boundaries. We can think about it in terms of noise, if you like. I want the freedom to be able to speak freely in this conversation. And so you can hear me clearly, and then it goes into a can, and then it's recorded, and then other people can listen to it freely. But if you and I were speaking in front of 8 billion people right now, and there was no limit as to whether they could shout at the same time, and there's no limit to whether they could cheer me if they say something I like or boo me if I say something they don't like, we would have complete chaos. We would have an unlivable space. There are always boundaries around every context. I have a conversation, it's in that context. If there was no boundaries around it, I wouldn't be able to say private things or confidential things or personal things. I wouldn't be able to say any of that because anyone could be listening. So there is no social situation that doesn't have boundaries in it. In other words, speaking to 8 billion people simultaneously isn't a social situation at all. And we pretend that it is because we brand this as social. We brand the platforms that offer this possibility as social platforms. But this is a complete myth. It's an attempt to construct a simulacrum of the social that has actually directly antisocial properties.
Yeah, you talk about the amplification of toxic content that plays into the business models of these profit-seeking companies that need engagement. And as you write, the sensational or the false or the otherwise harmful content tends to be the content that generates the most engagement. With this sort of system of the world's most powerful corporations inserting themselves in every social context and amplifying the worst possible communication, there is no possible way to build a healthy democracy or society. And I appreciated that you went a little bit into political theory, dipping into Thomas Hobbes, Leviathan, and other works to remind us what are the conditions that a society needs in order to have healthy communication, healthy deliberation, and decision-making. In one part, you are talking about Hobbes' Leviathan, and you write that that model of politics is now breaking apart. as you point out, there is no mutuality between you and Facebook or between you and other Facebook users. So here what you're pointing out is in a society, there has to be some shared interest in a coherent, cohesive political body or process. And when everything goes through Facebook, which is predicated on this horrible algorithmic amplification, that mutuality, that social contract, that itself dissolves and we're left adrift.
That's right. I'm no political theorist, but I, as part of the early stages of writing this book, I tried to think, well, something's happening with space. Maybe I should look at political theorists and see if I can get any clues from them about how space should be designed. From a review of political theory, it's clear that there are some pretty strict limits they build into politics being possible. One is the oldest Aristotelian model that politics is natural, but only on very small scales. The polis, okay, various smart ways of building it up through federation to something a bit bigger, maybe even a republic, as in the early days of the US. But it still has to be bounded in some way. And it's the spatial expansion's control, because you know, once you go beyond that, you have chaos or you have violence or the whole thing breaks down. Leviathan from Thomas Hobbes was looking at English society literally breaking down in the Civil War in the 17th century. And he didn't start in such an optimistic way. He believed that violence was the natural condition of man, the war of all against all. But he saw one way you could get under control, which was to ensure that you had one central authority, which he wanted to be in the form of a king, but we couldn't call it a prime minister or president or a legal system or whatever, that each one of us is equally subject to, and we each know that the other is equally subject to that. So our relations are all governed by that hidden central reference point, each one of us equally. But now that's not happening, because some people point out we have something that's a bit like a Leviathan authority, which is Facebook, except that we're not equally, we're not in relations to each other in any way. It controls each of us personally, sending us different stuff. So it's a slightly different little algorithm as it affects each one of us. So that's not the same as the Leviathan in that way. And it doesn't involve any obligations that we have to each other. The only obligation that we have to ourselves is to shout as loud as we can from the rooftops.
Try to get as much engagement as we can.
Yeah, that's very different from what Hobbes had in mind. He did not have that in mind at all. But meanwhile, insofar as we are in little worlds looking towards the center, they're fragmented, because social media fragments us into mutually exclusive little communities. And so we become polarized in our small little fragments of the Leviathan. So instead of being something that literally binds us, the Leviathan in fragments becomes something that exposes us to each other in a way that makes us hate each other more, that polarizes us from each other. It has exactly the opposite effect of what Hobbes was. In fact, it provokes exactly what he didn't want, which is the war of all against all, or the war of every group against every other group. And I'm, as I said, I'm not a political theorist, but I'm trying to read political theory as a citizen and say something has gone very, very wrong here. That we've literally turned upside down or turned into Humpty Dumpty and split into 1,000 pieces what were reasonably good ideas, perfect ideas of politics, and we messed them up and we didn't even notice.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you are listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We are halfway through my interview with Nick Coldry, author of the book, The Space of the World: Can Human Solidarity Survive Social Media? And What If It Can't? As I said before, this is Nick Coldry's second time on Tectonic. His previous book with Ulysses Mejias was called Data Grab. It was about data colonialism, and you can find that interview in the archives at tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. This is a book that ties nicely into those ideas. We're going to mention data colonialism in the second half, and you can hear that we are talking about similarly urgent issues on a global scale, thanks to the growth at any cost ethos of the unethical Silicon Valley big tech giants. Let's go ahead and listen now to the second half of my interview with Nick Couldrey here on Tectonic.
I want to say for listeners, this book is not just about Facebook. You also bring up Snapchat, Twitter, Google's YouTube. You also bring up TikTok. In fact, on TikTok, you say TikTok represents the ultimate version of the algorithmic model. The result is the most sophisticated personalization machine yet built. And you're referring there to the possibility of these machines to polarize the citizens. So let's talk a little bit about polarization and how these services create this. Here's a quote to start us off. I like this a lot. Social media's enzyme for accelerating polarization has created a polarization machine on the scale of the planet, an experiment in which there is nothing to stop ever more extreme behavior being incentivized every day. I thought that really wrapped it up together. It's an accelerant that is global, and it doesn't seem immediately like there's anything that can stop it.
No. And for me, what brought that home above all was a moment that I'm sure stuck in many people's memory, that terrible moment in March, I think 2018 or 2019, perhaps, when a guy walks into a mosque in Christchurch with his, you know, his rifle, assault rifle or whatever it was, and he's wearing a GoPro camera, and he's planned to massacre people, and he's commenting as he goes into the mosque and as he does kill people, and he's broadcasting it simultaneously on Facebook. Facebook closed it down relatively quickly, but of course, by then it was out there, and of course, that video was shown endless times on other toxic sites, which of course are the sort of hinterland of social media. But the key thing is that Facebook had been incentivizing people to use their GoPro cameras linked to their Facebook account to broadcast live as another way of getting engagement.
And by the way, I want to remind listeners that that was not a one-off. Facebook has doubled down on that strategy. Now they're partnering with Ray-Ban to create surveillance glasses, which now can take photos and videos from glasses and upload directly to the cloud for further engagement. So how long will it be until we see another tragedy that doesn't come through GoPro, but comes through Facebook's own surveillance glasses?
That's a great point. So this is not an accidental idea. It comes from, and this is where we get back to data colonialism just briefly. It underlies the idea, data colonialism, that the social world is just there to be made money out of. It's our world. It's the only social world we've got. It's the world from which all our possibilities come. But there are now executives who think, well, we can make money out of that very space of possibility. If you like the social air that we breathe. The problem of polarization has been picked up by many, many political scientists who are acutely worried about it for a long time. That's hardly a discovery by me. This is happening in every country. It's not just happening in the US, almost every country we can think of. Taiwan is one of the few countries that's actually managed to control polarization. And interestingly, as Audrey Tang, the minister for Taiwan, pointed out, through a radically different design of social media that's trying to reduce polarization. But in almost every other country, polarization is a problem. So I started digging into the literature a bit more, and I came across the work of a brilliant political scientist at Stanford, Shanto Iyengar, and one of his pieces, which brought out how American society, how serious what he calls affective polarization is. It's not polarization in opinions, because there's a lot of opinions we sort of share in common. After all, we share a lot more these days, but polarization in feelings. And this is on the rise. And what really interested me was to find, well, how did he start to make sense of that? And he dipped into a form of social psychology. And again, I'm not a psychologist. I'm writing this, if you like, as a citizen, as a social theorist. he dipped into some social psychology from the 1970s and 1980s that really hit the nail on the head. These people, long before social media was ever imagined, decided in great experiments in a laboratory to see what makes people more polarized. They had a theory that people are naturally like ready to be polarized because we're social animals and monkeys have huge fights and form arguments and tribes and whatever. So they had the sense it was natural. But what makes it worse? What makes it worse? And their argument was terrifyingly simple. You create a room with 100 people in it. You arbitrarily say that you guy, 50 people, you're on one team because you're on the left of the room. You other guys, you're on the other team because you're on the right of the room, entirely arbitrary. And then let them talk amongst each other, incentivize them to say that they're on that side. So they're not on the other side. Get them to do things where they're incentivized to say, well, I'm on this side and you guys over there, you're on the other side. And what you very quickly create is a polarized room because you have created an incentive to mark your identity and a meaning for the identity out of that marking. What is a social media platform except exactly that? You're incentivized to like this, which means not liking that. Incentivized to have these friends, which means not other people. To push this stuff around because it's your friend's stuff, not that other stuff. That is exactly what a social media space is. It's like an experiment guaranteed to amplify polarization. So no one would say social media created polarization. It's inherent in human beings. They created a brilliant machine to guarantee that it's amplified every single time.
And because of this engagement-based business model, these companies, in the end, are dependent on some amount of sludge being uploaded to their services because that's what delivers the most engagement. And so inevitably you have problems because you have this horrific content, whether it's child sexual abuse or torture videos or beheadings or other just unthinkably horrible acts that are depicted in video. Those get uploaded into the sludge factory. And Facebook and the other companies say, well, we're so committed to giving everyone this nice, delightful experience. What we're going to do is we're going to hire moderators to watch all the bad stuff and take them out of the feed. And as you point out, another connection to data colonialism from your book, Data Grab, these moderators are often based in poorer countries. These are vulnerable populations who then have to do the cleanup work that supports the toxic models based in Northern California. And that leads to all sorts of mental health harms. And you write about this idea of moderation beyond being unfair. You said, ultimately, it's not going to work. You write, even if moderation processes were better resourced and more efficient, we should not be relying on individual people in any organization to fix issues that affect the political culture of whole countries. And that's what we're looking at. I mean, the genocide in Myanmar that Facebook was complicit in because it had under-resourced its moderators, among other reasons, Facebook said, well, we'll just hire a few more moderators, as though hiring five more moderators in Myanmar is going to hold back the hyperpolarization across the entire country that Facebook is dependent on for its business model.
That's right. And I think the environmental analogy really helps here because there was a time in human history where we didn't have sewage systems at all. And an awful lot of people were sick almost all the time, and no one really understood why. Gradually, a sense emerged of what was going wrong, that something that seemed innocent actually was profoundly dangerous, and we had to control waste going into the water supply and all these things. But we did it through a whole infrastructure, countless power plants to do that. We invested vast amounts on the national scale to do that, and we still have to, and we know we have to. Whereas Facebook, on the one hand, as you say, was still making money out of having toxified the river. They were still silently benefiting from that. But also they employed a small number of people at the lowest possible wage, i.e. the other side of the planet, people who were as vulnerable as possible and therefore desperate to take that low wage, it outsourced it so that it had plausible deniability when the costs emerged, although it's now been successfully sued in the Kenyan courts by the people working for SAMA, the Kenyan company, with some quite horrific evidence emerging in that trial. But there just aren't enough human beings on the planet to moderate this stuff. In fact, there shouldn't be no one human being who has to see this stuff. This is the worst stuff that humanity produces. It's true that AI also can't moderate it because AI has to be trained. And AI has no idea what's evil and what's good. It's just a machine. So someone has to train the AI, and that is a problem. So that takes us back to the question of scale. If you build a system where the bad stuff can swill around across the whole planet without barriers and with some pushing along the way, and then you try and regulate that system, you're never going to control the problems. And as we said, you should not have human beings themselves just taking on the burden of that. That's an inhuman thing that Facebook did there. So instead, you have to change the system. That means reduce the scale, move down to a smaller scale, a scale maybe where social media is built around communities where, yes, there's a small number of people who take on the difficult task of taking on the loudmouth, the aggressive bully who insults people, and they take on that unpleasant task. Not everyone's up for that, but we all know communities where there are people who can manage that and do it successfully, and it's not unimaginable. And meanwhile, you hope there's no one truly evil or psychopath in your community. If there is, well, you have to rely on other national and specialist resources. But communities in society are able to some degree cope with that and imagine what it would take to cope with that. But on the scale of 8 billion people, no one can imagine what it takes to cope with that. It's unimaginable. It's just not possible. And it's complete nonsense of Facebook even to claim that they can do this, because they never can. And the problem is they're on the wrong scale. They're just too big.
Let's talk about scale, because this is a good segue to the last set of questions about solutions. You do finish this book with good news that there are some early indications that there are ways to build social media that are actually positive for communities, that are encouraging of better conversations, and might even make for healthier politics. And scale is where you start with this discussion. If anybody wants a great book that expresses what I believe, and I think you too, Nick, about building technology correctly, go find the book by Ivan Illich called Tools for Conviviality. This is a classic. And Nick, you're drawing on Illich's work near the end of the book. You write about Illich in a chapter called Rebuilding Social Media. And you write, quote, "The right relationship is when individuals and communities have control of their tools and can use them for their own ends. Social media, as they exist today," you're saying, "are the polar opposite of Illich's vision of a convivial society." So what you're saying here is the scale is really important to make things human-sized, community-sized, not global-sized, and that's a way to begin rebuilding things in a healthy way online.
That's right. It's not an easy problem because, of course, we've all become a bit addicted to global connectivity. We like finding stuff from around the world and having people send it to us. And of course, I'm not saying that instinct is wrong, but if it's true that there's a fundamental design flaw in the big global spaces we've got at the moment, then we can't ignore that. And this is where I find Illich is really useful. 50 years ago, he was looking at a different set of problems, the capitalism and the market and industrial production. He was looking to a post-industrial moment. But when I went back to his book, which I read years ago, when I went back to it, I was astonished to find that what did he see as one of the risks of capitalism run riot in our tools and in our basic living spaces? Polarization.
Huh.
So he wasn't wrong. You know, he had a gut feeling that's how you do things wrong. That's how you get it fundamentally wrong.
On the subject of scale, you write that the default rule must be build social media always to the smallest scale needed. This is something that Illich, of course, would have very much supported. And you bring up an example that I had never encountered before. I like this a lot. You bring up emergency call services. Here in the U.S., it's 911. If you call 911, you point out that 911, or whatever it is in your home country, is not a national service. It's handled and managed locally. And so if we have designed that effective system as a local response to local emergencies, that would be a good model for how we think about social media as well.
That's right. And I think this should be our starting point. I've been very inspired by the Fediverse, the federated social media that for many people is really off-putting because it seems pretty technical to use. And techies love it because you have to go through all sorts of hoops to work out what instance you're on and how to send a post that can be reached by another instance and so on. But the key thing about the Fediverse, leaving the tech aside, is they got the thinking right. Their idea is that social media should never be for profit. And secondly, it should be designed on the smallest scale possible. Small instances under the control, maybe one person, perhaps from their bedroom, who is willing to put the time in to sustain and keep an eye on and, where necessary, moderate and take tough action of a small community up to maybe 1,000 people. It's a lot of work. And therefore, there's the issue of how you resource that long term. There's clearly issues there. The whole system is funded through donations. Their principle is the right one. Design at the smallest scale. There are problems because you can only allow small scale things to then connect to each other if you make them on an open source protocol that anyone can pick up. So they're basically interoperable systems. That means that someone like Donald Trump can say, thank you very much. I will use exactly that protocol behind Truth Social, which is his. So he's technically part of the Fediverse, but not part of the Fediverse that I'm interested in. But you can't rule it out any more than you could rule it out in the real world. There can be places in the world where people you really don't like live, and you have to accept they live there. And that seems to me a very sane way of thinking about how you design space where we deal with each other, where we talk to each other. Now, I'm strongly in favor of that, and I'm also on Blue Sky because although Blue Sky is not federated strictly, it's got an open source protocol, but it's the only one in its own federation. And by the way, Mastodon is just a Twitter-like thing, but there are also equivalents for Instagram and WhatsApp. Similar Fediverse-type things exist on the same philosophy. There's money going into these platforms now because the need for something different is palpable in the world we're in, the need to reduce polarization. And there's a sense that something could be done. But of course, we can't do anything individually. We have to do it collectively, and we have to help each other shift across. And the two other things I mentioned are probably really fundamental for helping with this. One is we need regulators, and maybe this will happen in Europe before it happens in the US, given the way things are. But we need regulators to ensure we really do have a market in social media. Facebook say they're a market entity, but they're actually a monopoly, operating on the fact everyone is compelled to be there because everyone else is there. They're not a market entity at all, in fact. If you went into a coffee shop and had a nice coffee with a few friends you found were there, and then the coffee shop owner said, well, I'm really glad you enjoyed the coffee, but you know, you can't drink coffee again with these friends or with any friends, in fact, unless you stay in my coffee shop. Is that okay? You would say, well, that is not a market. But that's exactly what we got in social media. And yet we still pretend it's a market and that it should be protected by free market and shouldn't be regulated. It's crazy. So if we could have regulators could take that on, and Cory Doctorow has also been really strong on this point, then we can imagine a situation where everyone is sick of X or Facebook. They can say to all their friends, let's all shift over to this other platform, take all our contacts, everyone we know, and hopefully most of them will land on the other side, and then we'll start over under a different business model in a more congenial place. But you can't do that at the moment. So that needs to change. And there's one other thing I'd say, and this is drawing some really interesting ideas. I mentioned Audrey Tang, the brilliant transgender person in Taiwan, the world's first transgender minister, and a brilliant mind who developed the idea at a time when Taiwan was really polarized, that there were hidden pools of agreement underneath all that polarization. And that if you could use AI to somehow draw those to the surface a little bit by listening carefully, operating with a very different business model, not trying to make money, just trying to draw hidden consensus, you could create a force that would gradually reduce polarization. And I know people working on a design for social media platform that's trying to do this right now. So there's some really interesting thinking going on. All I'm really trying to say is that if the problems are as deep as I've laid them out to be, and I feel I'm just really summing up the consensus of whole societies on this, then we have no choice but to do something. The only other choice is to go on living in a polluted water supply. There's a lot of good water there, but it's endlessly going to be mixed with the bad stuff, and there's nothing we can do about it until we redesign.
That's right. We have no choice. We have to move forward, and this book gives us a great description of the problem and some pointers to possible solutions that people can get involved in. The book is called The Space of the World: Can Human Solidarity Survive Social Media, and What If It Can't? By my guest today, Nick Couldrey. Nick, thanks again for coming back on the show, and I hope you'll be back again sometime.
I hope so too. It's a great pleasure as always. Thanks, Mark.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you are listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the remaining 10-ish minutes of the show. We just heard my interview with Nick Couldrey, whose new book is called The Space of the World: Can Human Solidarity Survive Social Media, and What If It Can't? And I hope you heard a couple of different sides to that subtitle. One is that we really are facing an urgent problem here of social media being designed in such a way to dissolve all the boundaries of our social interactions, in a way, dissolve the effectiveness of our politics. I mean, just look around at what's happening. And call into question, as Nick said, the conditions for survival of society itself. I mean, I'm not trying to sensationalize anything or overstate it. I'm just reading his very persuasive argument from drawing from different political theorists, whether it's Hobbes or Aristotle or others. And these various writers of the past have said, here's what you need in order to have a viable society, to have viable politics that can come to some kind of consensus, can generate some decision-making, and keep people from hating each other all the time. And it just seems like in this economy, this society that is so dominated by Facebook, Google's YouTube, TikTok, Snapchat, and all of the toxic algorithmic services out there, those conditions have been stripped away. And it, again, just look at where we are right now, and that begins to, I think, help explain why things are so deeply fractured. And as I was putting this this show together, I remembered that there was a sound file that I played several years ago. This was back in 2018. So we're talking early on in the Tectonic run, you know, 7 years ago. There had been a brief skit on The Daily Show that was pointing out the divisions in society even back then due to the Facebook algorithm. And I mean, those, looking back to 2018, those were simpler times considering everything that's happened since then. But I thought it'd be interesting to revisit that little skit, as innocent fun as it was back then, because, again, like I said at the top of the show, just think about those effects that it's pointing out, and now multiply those by 8 billion, the scale of the world, and that's what we're facing right now. I'm going to play you this skit right now. It's just a couple minutes long, and what it depicts is Facebook as a bartender, Okay. And you're going to hear in this skit, the bartender tries to get people engaged in that particular way that only Facebook tends to get people engaged in the way they use that term. So here, let's listen to that skit, and then I'll have a couple of comments.
Hey, want to see a pic of my kid?
Nope. I'm heading out.
You want to stay for another drink?
Sorry, but this place kind of blows. I procrastinated long enough. I gotta get back to work.
Check it. Before you go, this guy says Bernie would have won.
Seriously? All right. Here's what I hate about Bernie Bros.
You want another drink?
Yeah, whatever. Bernie is a socialist. The idea that a Rust Belt voter would ever...
What do you know about Rust Belt voters? We're the real America. Bartender, another pitcher, please. We're going to be here a while.
Look, climate change is real. Did you even see Leonardo DiCaprio's documentary series?
Want to see a pic of my kid?
I'm tired of Hollywood elites telling us what to do. They should stick to acting.
They should stick to not sexually harassing. Hashtag Me Too. Hashtag Time's Up. Hashtag Boycott Hollywood.
Hey, take a joke, snowflake. LOL.
Hey, I know it's problematic for me to say this as a straight, white, cis male, but check your privilege and show this beautiful goddess some respect.
You need to do something about the misogyny in here.
Absolutely. And we're doing everything we can to block people like that from coming in here. And if we can't do that, we don't deserve to serve you. Speaking of, may I serve you?
Hell yeah, you can.
You know, in Sweden, they don't even have a word for poverty.
Black lives matter.
No, blue lives matter.
And all lives matter. You both wrong.
I think you mean you are both wrong.
Hey, you want to see a pic of my kid?
Stop it! Look at what this place is doing to you. It's toxic.
Yeah, you're right. Should we leave?
Community.
Yeah, this is how I connect all my friends.
A hell of a business.
It's that sense of community. This is how I connect to all my friends. I love that skit because it just ends in complete pandemonium, which is essentially the society and the politics that Facebook and other big tech companies have built for us today. And I hope that you enjoyed that interview that with Nick Coldry that delved into the roots of the problem and maybe some possibilities for how we can begin fixing it by looking into federated services and other possible solutions, which I hope to dive into in future episodes. But that's about all the time I have for you this evening. You are listening to the greatest radio station of the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Stay tuned for the great Dave Mandel. I have some homework for you for next time. I want you to avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. And I wanted to end with a song by a Tectonic fan here in the New York area by Carlo Petrow. This song is called Kaizen, and it's a great pick for Tectonic. Have a great week, everybody. I'll see you next time.
Like I said, it was a continuous improvement to improve the product.
Continuous improvement.
Kaizen, that's what the Japanese call it.
Kaizen. In Japanese, sounds to me like a euphemism for trying to avoid devastatingly deadly responsibility of corporate executives.
And we're happy to continue to do so.
We're working with a vast array of experts in this field, and we are constantly looking at ways to improve the product. Kaizen. It's
continuous improvement.
You know, go from good to great.
That was the big push in the 80s.
I like the concept.
Kaizen. It gave me chills.
Feels good, right?
Feels good.
So it's a continuous improvement.
Continuous improvement?
Yes, sir.
Sounds like you could have and should have protected customers from these deadly devices.
So the answer is yes.
Yes.
Yes, no.
Yes,
but no.
You don't say. You do say.
You do say, yeah.
You don't say.
Who did you say you were?
He didn't say.
And we need great companies that can endure through wave after wave after wave of creative destruction.
And any feedback, positive or negative, is greatly appreciated.
That seems fairly benign.
Are you taking enough risk?
What are you buying?
Crypto.
Are you being authentic?
Crypto.
Are you still learning?
Crypto.
What does over-delivering look like in your industry?
Crypto. Crypto.
It's about going from good to great.
Never stop.
We're moving forward.
Continue to be unapologetic.
Well, I'm glad we're coming up with some ideas and stuff.
You know, is everyone a mentor to you?
My mom was very encouraging, so there you go.
God, I wish
my mom was here.
My mother is in Denver, so she can't come to work.
Wait. So you're bringing your mom to work every day?
They're off. Good evening and welcome to another episode of It's Complicated, an hour of Prague and Prague-adjacent music. I'm your host, Dave Mandel, following, as usual, hot on the heels of Mark Hurst's program, Tectonic. I'll be here till 8, and we're going to start tonight's show with a track that I have to confess, I was unaware of until recently, and of course it was one of the brilliant denizens of the WFMU comments board that alerted me to it. This is going to be a cover of the Henry Cow song "War," an amazing, really complicated, brilliant piece written by Anthony Moore and Peter Blegvad, and this is a version of that song done by The Fall. Yes, The Fall. How did I not know about this? So I'm going to play a cover version of Henry Cow's War, performed by The Fall. And then, what the heck, as long as I'm there, I will play Anthony Moore, who composed the music to the tune, also covered it, slightly different version of it, on one of his solo albums. So I'm going to play The Fall doing War, followed by Anthony Moore doing War. And here we go.
Obscurity.
cats and dogs. Tell the boss to walk in on her. Well, she cast a spell, spread an egg and war was born. And pillage up with gusto, even though they have no nerve. And she does just look on.